Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Doug Sovereign, reporter for KCBS Radio in San Francisco, your moderator for the program. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, or you can download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Poe Bronson, novelist and author, whose latest book is Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Poe Bronson is well known not just in the Bay Area but around the world as a novelist and a best-selling author of narrative nonfiction. He's published 6 books. He's written for television, radio, magazines, newspapers, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, NPR. You may remember his book, What Should I Do With My Life? It was a number one New York Times bestseller. It stayed near the top of that list for almost a year. My first introduction to Poe Bronson was his terrific and very funny novel, Bombardiers, which was his debut, about his experiences selling bonds in San Francisco. With Ashley Merriman, Poe Bronson has written award-winning articles for New York Magazine and Time Magazine on the science of parenting. They collaborated on another bestseller on that subject, Nurture Shock, and now they write for Newsweek.com. Bronson was born in Seattle. He graduated from Stanford. He lives here in San Francisco. Please welcome Poe Bronson.
Thank you, Doug. So there is sports a little bit in every chapter of this book. And I love sports. I don't know why I love sports. When I spend so much time watching sports, I don't know if, like, is that good for me or bad for me? Is this just a distraction of my competitive energy otherwise? What is the role of sports in the world? And I struggle with it because we are also trying to deal with some important issues in the book. The good thing about sports from a science perspective is that there's lots of leagues and lots of sports and lots of data. And so scholars can find a workplace situation and find a parallel in sports and find what the dynamic is in sports and then see if that tests and reapplies back and say the workplace situation, the political situation. And I struggle with this until we discovered something. So the ancient Greeks were known primarily for a couple things. One, the Olympics, and two, democracy. Now, in your own mind, I might have planted something already, but ask yourself, before you walked in here, did you think there was any real connection between the Olympics and democracy? And for most people, you'd say, you know, I hadn't really thought about that. I didn't think that there was a connection. So the Olympics were actually a religious festival to start. They were the ceremonial lighting of the temples of Zeus, and people came from throughout Asia Minor. And what was interesting is they had, during that religious festival, a truce so that people could cross through one country to another to get there. It was very important to all the peoples in that region. And over time, as this grew, it was every 4 years religious festival, more and more people, important people started to come. And there became this issue, is who's going to light the throne, right? Now we have this ritual where people run all around the world handing this thing off to light the ceremonial thing. But back then, they were like, I want to light it. No, you want to light it. No, you want to light it. And they were like, we're going to have a war over who's going to light this thing. So they decided to come up with, in 776 BC, a 200-yard foot race. And they decided that the winner of the foot race, someone from each contingent in each region, would have somebody racing, and the winner would get to light it. And that would be fair. And they decided that would be fair. And as it went from a 200-yard foot race, they began to add other events, such as wrestling and longer running and boxing. And they wanted races and events where you could clearly see who had won and lost, and it could not be rigged. And later, 3 centuries later, a boxer named Eupolos bribed some of his opponents, and he was ceremonially, not himself, but a statue of him was set outside the Olympic Stadium, never allowed in. Imagine if we had not letting Pete Rose into the Hall of Fame, but actually did a statue of Pete Rose outside the Hall of Fame saying, you will never get in. We might have, good, thank you. We might have less people cheating. We said, we're not just going to forget you. We are going to memorialize you for eternity. So, people came and there were these events. And they, at the time, they believed in this idea of aretas. Aretas was this supreme Grecian virtue. It was this notion that through constantly competing, you honed your psyche and you didn't become immoral. You became more and more moral through fair competition and recognizing the integrity of it and respecting your opponent and learning to win and lose gracefully. And it became a bigger and bigger thing with more events and more people coming. And they decided that the way it worked was the athletes would come a month ahead of time. And so all the contingent would come a month ahead, and they would train for a month. And at the time, Greek society, like everything in the world until then, power was bestowed through birth. And they had an idea that if you were the king's son, you were the best. And what they saw in the athletes, as the athletes trained their bodies over the course of the month, was that by making themselves physically better, someone of a lower caste could transcend someone of a higher caste. And you could have a soldier of a low caste who's suddenly there working out and he could beat everybody. And all of the people who came were watching this and going, I wonder if you could do the same for your mind. I wonder if through intellectual rigor and debating ideas and discussing, you could raise your mind to level and you could transcend your caste. And the very first notion of transcending where you come from and what you can do in life came right out of that sporting contest. And there, the Pan-Hellenic orators and philosophers gathered around the sports, and they were there for a month, and the first time they were together in the same room, like at Yahoo, talking to each other and debating things and coming up with ideas. And they understood, again, all of this was under the notion of a truce. And so the Pan-Hellenic truce came out of the Olympics. And through those endless debates in that month-long period of the Olympic training, they formed the notion of democracy, that people would come together and could debate ideas in front of each other. Of course, I'm monopolizing in the room right now, but it would be much like this, except there would be 30,000 people there. And that everybody would get to vote and that you could transcend where you came from. And the idea that mere sports led to the foundation of democracy, that is a form of ideological competition in the world that's led to what we have today, made me feel a little less guilty about putting some of the sports in the book. You know, one of my favorite sports stories is of Anson Dorrance, who is the women's college soccer coach at the University of North Carolina. He is by far, I've gotten to know him over the last 2 years, he is by far the most successful college coach in any sport in all of North America. They have won 22 of the 33 national titles in the last 33 years, since they started doing national titles in women's soccer. They won again most recently in December with a 4-1 win over Penn State. It's really interesting to hear how Anson does it. How did he create such a powerhouse? And when originally he actually coached the men's team and then was asked to take over the women's team. This was 33 years ago. And he didn't do the men's team for too long, once he started winning all the time with the women. But he had a very strong feeling when he had those original girls to practice, was that he felt like they were very technical players, they were very good players, but they had not learned to really compete. They had come from cultures where it had been forbidden to value winning over relationships. And Anson was tasked with growing these girls and teaching them how to compete in this domain and hopefully take it forward in life. We're talking about Mia Hamm and Carla Overbeck and other, you know, World Cup players. We're also talking about a lot of people just went ahead and succeeded in life in other domains. And he felt it was very important to them. So he decided very determinedly that I am going to coach them just like I coached the men. And he called them only by their last names, and he yelled at them in practice, and he made them do these drills called mangle. They had things called Terrible Tuesdays, where puking in the bushes was common. And he made them compete. He kept score, inspired by what Dean Smith did with the basketball program. He created a 23-factor matrix where every player was rated, judged all the time. And you came off practice field and your results, where you stood in the pecking order, it was brutal. It is brutal. I helped manage youth soccer here in the San Francisco, and I can't imagine anything like this. I can't imagine doing this to my kids. But he's trying to win national soccer titles. And it succeeded. And one of his first players was April Heinrichs. She was someone who cared greatly about relationships and what people thought of her off the field. But when she stepped on the field, she cared only about putting the ball in the goal. And the rest of the players had a mutiny, and they came to Anson, and they said, you know, we don't really like your attitude. And he said, I don't like your attitude. I want you to play more like her and less like the way you're playing. I want more April Heinrichs in the world. And they were sort of shocked. No one had ever done that to them before, and said, you have to learn to compete. And he was enormously successful, and they won and they won and they won. However, there was a young girl when he was up in Michigan one summer, and he was training the Olympic Development Program team for that region. And there was a young player named Carla Worden, later Carla Overbeck. And she was 15 years old, and he was with his team when his father passed away. And he knew the girls were concerned that he was with them and not with his dad when his dad passed away. So he told the girls it was okay. My dad at first did not support me being a college soccer sport, but you know, when I won, he started to support me. Or really, when he saw how much I loved it, he started to support me. And he's dead, but he wanted me to be here with you rather than with him at this time. And he knew how important it was. And he thought that was it. And later he walked out of his room outside the motel they were staying in. This is in Ypsilanti. And there was a payphone booth, and 15-year-old Carla Worden was on the phone with her family. And she was in tears, and she was crying, and she was telling her family that their coach's dad had died. And Anson wasn't crying, but here was this player who was so concerned for him, so concerned for his relationship, that she was crying as she was telling her parents about it. And it finally got to him that, man, maybe these girls, maybe the relationships do matter to them, and maybe I should respect that. Anson's stressing toolboxes all the same. He still stresses his players out in practice, but his de-stressing toolbox since 1996 has been different. He has learned how to de-stress his players just as much as he stresses them up. And he de-stresses them especially around games. He writes them, gives them roses. He writes them letters that they read in the, positive affirming letters they read in the soccer, in the locker room. And he describes his best halftime speeches ever. Back when he coached the men, the most successful halftime speech he ever gave, they were down 2-1, and he came in like a caged tiger, and he was so mad, he was trying to think of what to say, and he saw his garbage can, and instead he just field-goaled that garbage can through the window, smashed the window, and stormed out. And to him, evolutionary, he says, that spoke volumes to the young male players. Like, get with it, get stressed out, go play, turn it up. And they did, and they won, and they blew out the team in the second half. He was like, it was the most successful thing ever. So his most successful halftime speech he uses with his female young players is quite different. He comes in, they're losing 2-1, like a caged tiger storming around. And then he says, well, what do you think? That's it. What do you think? And the girls start going, oh, well, you know, I could have done this better. And, you know, maybe we should move another player into this kind of spot. And that player is very speedy. Maybe we have a faster player, a guarder. And they all begin to take responsibility and have ideas. And the fact that he didn't yell at them makes them really, like, happy. And they're wanting to work their butt off for this guy. And they work it on themselves. All he says is, he's this amazing motivator. What does he do? What do you think? That's it. And they go out and they cream people. And I thought that was very important to me because, not just because as a volunteer I helped manage youth soccer in San Francisco, but One of my biggest surprises from this book and this research, and the thing I was most reluctant to believe in, and the thing I did not want to go towards, was any gender differences in competitive styles. As a son of a single working feminist mother, I didn't want to go there. When we had written Nurture Shock, Ashley and I, we would see gender differences between boys and girls, but they're always like 1% and 2% and 3%. And we would see other journalists go, oh, boys are better than girls at this, or girls are better than boys at that. And I'm like, it's a couple of percent, like individual differences dwarf any small differences like that. And we thought it would be the same thing here. And Ashley herself, she used to work in the White House, in the Clinton administration, and she used to have bosses, women who would bring her leadership books, and they would be all about how women are collaborators. And she'd be like, I'm not a collaborator, I'm competitive. Like, what are you talking about? And she didn't want to go here too. But sometimes these differences were too great to ignore. And the biggest difference I can give you is not talking about 1% or 2% or something like that. The biggest thing I can give you is that in the November election in 2012, we had women on ballots, and the women who were on those ballots did very well. But in the entire United States, not in the final post-primary, you know, thing, but even, or even the primary, in the entire United States, 180 million American women, only 4 filled out anything to run for governor in the United States of America. And when we look at women's underrepresentation in Congress, which, despite the victories, is only 18%, and I do not call that a victory, we have to we've had a lot to this, we need to bring some science to it. And the most exciting science that I found with Ashley was from Sarah Fulton at Texas A&M. And prior to this time, in political sciences, they don't talk about it much because it's kind of taboo, but there was an understanding or assumption that in some ways women are not putting themselves on the ballot. And are they worried about the competition? Is it worry about the campaign? What is it? What's going on? What Sarah Fulton did was she began polling state senators. And what she did was she would ask them to evaluate what their odds were if they ran for U.S. Congress. State senators are perfectly positioned to make that next jump to Congress, right? And she would ask them what their odds were, and then she would ask them whether they were likely to run in the coming election. And she found something really interesting, which is that when the odds of winning are below 20%, all of the entrants will be men. But once the odds get to 20%, women start jumping into the race, and very quickly, more women will enter the race than men will. That not all women, because we could go into some of the biological differences and that kind of thing, but that once women feel like they have a decent chance to win, they're actually more competitive than men. Men, it seems, are very good at ignoring the odds, and women are actually very good at judging the risk of losing and don't want to waste time with losing. That can be a good thing or it can be a bad thing, depending on the environment that you're in. Here in Silicon Valley, we're very concerned that still only 4.3% of venture-backed companies are founded by women, that even in startup employees, women are outnumbered by men 2-1. And we wonder why. We wonder if it's a boys' club or we wonder if it's about engineering. It could be also related to the odds of startup creation and how women judge those odds and judge those risks. But judging risk accurately can be really great for you. In an amazing study on Wall Street looking at every financial analyst earnings per share projection from 1983 to 2006, this is research done by Alok Kumar at University of Texas, he found that female financial analysts on Wall Street are 7.3% more accurate than male financial analysts. Men tend to be over-optimistic and not see risks where women judge risk quite accurately. It's interesting. I don't know if anybody here has a hedge fund. I'd recommend buying the women and selling the men. Thank you very much. I got to sit down with you now, right?
Come sit down.
Those are my notes for the talk. Thank you.
And our thanks to Poe Bronson. His latest book, of course, is Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. And now we have time for our question period, and we have some questions from the audience. I have a few of my own, and I look forward to getting some more from you. I like that. Instead of buy low, sell high, it's buy from women and sell to men. That's a new stock approach I'll have to employ.
The science says that when a female financial analyst tells you to sell a stock, you should really listen to her.
But now, just to explore this a little bit more, is it that men are delusional and women are clear-eyed? And,
yeah.
Or is it, are men so much more competitive that they think even when they the odds are against them, that's all right, I'll overcome that, I can win this thing?
Those are the same thing. Right. If you bring men into a room and you give them a task that they've never seen before, they think, I'm going to be fine with that. And women are like, I've never seen this before. I don't know if I'm going to be any good at that. And if you give them something that they've done before, men come and say, I've done that before. I'm going to be great at that. Women come and say, I've done that before. I'm going to be good at that. And this is not true of all women. Just to be super clear, we have an audience here. This is for radio, I know. But will the audience please look at your right hand? And I want you to look at the length of your index finger and the length of your ring finger, okay? Now, I'm going to ignore the men for a second who are here in the audience. For all the women who are here, if you have a longer index finger than ring finger, please raise your hand. Okay. And if you have a longer ring finger than index finger, please raise your hand. So Paola Sapienza at Northwestern University, who studies the University of Chicago MBAs, as well as Aldo Rusticini, who studies Italian female entrepreneurs, would be very interested in those last group of you who have a longer ring finger. And they would suggest that you have what is tends to be more of a male pattern, and you would be highly likely to be a risk taker, be willing to have a surmount of testosterone response to challenge hormonally, and that you might have good spatial ability and would make a great entrepreneur. And in fact, at the University of Chicago, from looking at that alone, they can determine the likelihood of you going into a high-tech or high-finance career as opposed to going into a career with a safer projection. So some people transcend. In a sense, what am I talking about here? Well, the same thing in your mother's womb that lengthens your fingers is also acting upon the fetal brain, changing how the cell migration works in the hypothalamus, which makes people permanently more responsive to subtle changes in hormones, and changing in hormones is what happens when we get up for a challenge or get up for our job or get up to perform or try to accomplish our goals.
I'm going to go around looking at everyone's index fingers and ring fingers now to decide if they're a risk taker or they like to play it safe. Now, this is interesting. You've already cited many people whose research you've drawn upon for this book. How did you go about putting this together, finding the science? There's an awful lot of material in the back and the footnotes and the references going over the last few years and compiling what you're going to use and then translating it into something people would enjoy reading.
This is what we do. We're journalists. This is what we do. You know, how we go about it, we go to science conferences. We search endlessly. We talk to scholars. We do stuff like, you know, the back of some paper, there's 50 sites, and we dig up all those sites and look for those other ones. And we just dig, and read, and talk. And I can tell you, Ashley lives in Los Angeles, and I live in San Francisco. And you know, my family can tell when I was talking to Ashley too much that day because I don't have any attention span left at the end of the day. Ashley and I are very different types of competitors ourselves. We've realized that. This is not a book that's telling anybody how to compete. It's a book that helps you understand all these hidden factors that could be at play in how you achieve your goals, how you perform under pressure, how you handle challenge, how you directly compete in an actual competitive situation. And those factors can be different for each person, and each of us has some level where we actually perform our best. And so the book is trying to help people discover where they perform their best, not trying to make them into something they're not.
How did you go from writing short stories and then a novel, clearly based on your own experience, but fiction, to becoming, you're a science writer now. You've become a journalist, you refer yourself as a journalist, and you're focusing more on things that you probably didn't know a lot about 20 years ago. How did that happen?
Well, I guess it would be boredom, meaning wrote some novels. I loved them. They were great. They were funny. I thought they were good. And, you know, but then I wanted to stretch. I wanted to take risks. I wanted to do something new. Writing yet another novel didn't seem, different enough. It wasn't exciting enough. And I started turning to nonfiction, and then I wanted to do something totally different. I walked away from covering Silicon Valley for Wired and the New York Times Magazine in the summer of 1999 at the peak before the crash, and people thought I had called the crash, but no, I was just gotten bored. And I went off to try to do something else, or what should I do with my life, and I was doing social documentaries, and then I kind of got more something new.
and started turning to science writing.
Maybe you caused the crash. Maybe if you'd stayed a little longer.
I might have been able to sustain it. Sorry if I cost you any money there.
Here's a related question from the audience. You've written on very diverse topics, and have said how much you enjoy that. How do you avoid being a tourist on topics that are so complicated and have so much depth? For example, you touch on some of the things you're mentioning, genetic differences and hormones and the like in this book.
Well, I don't think anybody who's read any of my books had said it reads like I was a tourist. I study hard and do the work. Nurture Shock, writing about the science of child development. We won 9 national awards for that reporting. That research, that our work has been cited in 35 scientific journals, including like The Lancet and stuff. So it's meaningful, significant work, I hope. And I hope that it's disruptive. I hope that it changes people's lives and their perception, or what's the point of doing it.
See, now we've put you on the defensive there. So
a little bit, yeah. I'm a little competitive, yeah.
The competitive, now we know why you wanted to write about competitiveness. Now, somebody wants to know, in reaction to the little experiment there, if there's a finger-length pattern for men, and if a man has a longer index finger than ring finger, does that mean they would have more feminine traits, or is it just a matter of safe?
Well, it's
risk?
Not feminine traits. Again, this transcends gender. So the thing is, we look for things and we associate things with gender sometimes, when really there's underlying biologically or brain differences that have some association with gender but aren't really there. So in short, what the scientists would say, and it's not a great correlation, but it's a good correlation, that men on average, you know, maybe 2/3 of men are going to have a longer ring finger than index finger, and 1/3 of women are going to have a longer ring finger than index finger, and that's going to be suggestive, not determinative, of their biological predisposition towards risk and challenge. But all of the, I mean, people are like, oh, crap, you know, but all of the biological components, including genetics of the warrior gene that we write about, and all of those together, some people say that makes up 40% of competitiveness. Some people say it makes up 60%. You could just call it a tie, say it's 50%, and the other half is what you do with it. And no scholar whatsoever believes that on biology alone can someone have a robust competitive psyche. They must have a habits and lifetime of like learning and working through it, and a childhood oriented towards that to help them figure that out.
Now, Malcolm Gladwell got a lot of attention for Outliers and talking about, 10 years of practice and you'll get there, practice makes perfect. Is this book to some extent a response to that? You're making a counter-argument that it's not just practice that makes perfect. You want to really rise to your best, you need the level of competition.
Right. Well, should I pick a fight with Malcolm Gladwell?
Might depend on the length of your ring
should
finger.
Should I? What do you think? Well, no, okay, well, I'll just be clear. Is it... officially, we see this as additive to the equation, and that needing 10 years of experience to be an expert is, you do need a lot of stuff to become an expert. You drive a lot of knowledge through your brain, down into the cerebellum of your brain, where things become automatized. However, 10 years of practice is like, well, who gets that before they have to compete? And more than that is, we're not judged on how we practice. We're judged on how we perform. And the notions of what goes into actually that performance, 10 years of practicing at performing does help you. But, the difference between doing well in practice and doing well when it counts is drastic. If the New York Times recently, we had a 4,500-word story on the comp gene, nicknamed the warrior gene, which showed, and it talked about a study in Taiwan where ninth graders... in Taiwan, they have this incredibly severe, threatening system where you don't even get to go into a 10th grade academic school unless you pass this test, at which 65% of all Taiwanese children fail. It's so hard. We have some sample questions in the book. I don't know what page it is, but they're like, I looked at those things, and I'm like, they're harder than the GRE or the GMAT. I mean, and they're like, ninth graders have to do it. And so they go to these cram schools. It's enormously stressful. And some scholars genotyped the kids, and they were looking for this comp gene, which variation of the genes the kids have. And they found that those who have the warrior genes, normally to have a warrior gene is great. Without stress, you have a 10-point IQ advantage. And this is a better prefrontal cortex functioning without stress. But on that test, they sank. 8 percentage points. And so this test, this system was designed to take these very smart kids who know the stuff, but they do not respond to that kind of pressure. While there are other kids or other people and who actually need the stress to perform their best, and their brains don't work very well. You know, it's the sort of people, I'm not trying to put an umbrella around everybody who's slothful or lazy or doesn't get their homework done, but we all know people who don't take the day-to-day work quite as seriously, and they kind of need the deadline, they need the pressure, and that's when you can kind of count on them. And part of this is that some people's brain needs that. It raises their dopamine levels up to optimal for them to actually function mentally the best.
How can people find out if they're fairly early in their career or their life, whether there's someone who, you know, does well in practice but won't do well under pressure of competition, or vice versa? Some people practice well, some people perform well.
You never really quite know. I mean, it's interesting if people have a chance to read, they'll find themselves contemplating whether they are a warrior or a warrior. My wife, who knows, since she's a biologist, a bioimmunologist, knows a million things more about genes than I do. So she's convinced I'm a heterozygote, but I think I'll have warrior genes. You know, you debate these things. And, you can be great under pressure in one domain, but not in another. And you can think, I have this generalized ability to handle stress, you know, until you have to stand up on stage and talk in front of a stone-faced audience or something. Mm. Not that you are. That's a classic Trier social stress test. So,
did you find similarities among highly successful people across different disciplines? You talked to so many people in the writing of this book.
So you mean, are people who are high performers able to generalize that into different domains of their life?
Potentially. I mean, if an athlete,
a
politician or a musician.
I didn't really look for that as much. Mm-hmm. We did that with kids. Mm-hmm. And we would, especially regarding the warrior-warrior gene, we would interview a lot of parents whose kids had test-taking anxiety, or parents whose kids were super performers, kids who didn't study very hard and then got 2 800s, and people who, you know, studied in the pool floating around and then nailed the test. And they would say, yeah, that my kid, actually, when I'd ask about it, yeah, actually, he loves being the pitcher in the 9th inning of the Little League baseball game. Mm-hmm. While my other son, the same son who crashes on a standardized test, even though he's equally bright in the gifted program, et cetera, is a great baseball player too, except in those moments of high stress. So it does generalize somewhat. But again, we are talking, I don't want to confuse people. We're talking kids here, right? So in adults, the warrior-warrior gene thing somewhat goes away. It's still there, but as we age and we mature and we inoculate ourselves to the stresses of life and we build up a robust stress management response, we can take advantage of being a warrior gene. I was just in Los Angeles this morning. I hope I have not painted a picture here that to have the warrior gene is bad. I would think having 10 points of extra IQ is pretty good. But more than that, like if someone asked me in Los Angeles this morning, if you were the Secretary of State, you know, and you had the warrior gene, what would you do? And I'm like, that would be perfect. Because to worry is not a bad thing. To worry, evolutionarily, both the warrior gene is newer. The warrior gene is something we share with primates, and the warrior gene is something that's come along in the last 100,000 years, and it's very popular. It's spread evenly throughout the population and is as present as the warrior gene is, which means it's doing something good. And what it does is it allows people to think into the future, to plan, to worry about the future and strategize about it. And if you were the Secretary of State, that's what you need to do, is anticipate every future consequence possible and hopefully have the, you know, intellectual capacity to make the right decisions there.
Your mentioning of the Little League in the 9th inning brings us to another question from the audience. Clutch hitting has proven to be very hard to measure. Some people don't even think it really exists when they try to measure it. Though we all think of certain players and in other sports too as clutch,
right?
Michael Jordan in the closing seconds, he wanted the ball in his hands. Did you find any insights on that?
So the people who have read, no doubt, econometrics work on which use is clutch hitting in baseball real? Are streaks real? Right. Are hot streaks in sports real? Are looking at only from that data perspective. You must also look at it from a physiological perspective. So there's no doubt that people get into physiological states where, due to the correct mix of noradrenaline to adrenaline ratio, in their body, their blood vessels, all the smooth muscles that line their blood vessels relax, and the veins dilate, and the lungs dilate, and the heart is pumping, and you're getting more oxygen through the body, and you're getting more fuel, and it affects your neural systems too. The neural networks of fear get suppressed, the neural networks of reward get juiced up, and in that kind of state, someone is absolutely going to perform better than in another state. And so, you know, one of the most interesting ones to me was Jason Lezak, the American anchorman in the 2008 Olympics in the 4x100 freestyle relay. And it was one of the most famous moments of those Olympics at the Water Cube in Beijing. And the Americans did not have the four fastest swimmers in the pool. Jason Lezak was the oldest male swimmer. But what's interesting about him is that he cannot swim for himself as fast as he can for a team. And the why he was the American anchorman for 10 years, and I got to know Jason for the book, is that he reliably, in those circumstances, is clutch. He reliably posts 3 to 4 tenths of a second faster for his team than he could ever do on his own for his own race. And it's interesting. This is not a sport like basketball where you set picks, pass the ball, rebound, do all this stuff. This is a sport where you jump in the pool by yourself, you swim to the other end, you come back. The difference in individual swimming and team swimming is virtually indistinguishable except for the relay start, which is pretty much measured at 0.6 to 0.7 seconds. But the rest of it is exactly the same. And in that Olympics, when he had the fastest swimming he had ever done on his own was 47.67 seconds, he did the equivalent of a mom lifting a car to trap a rescue her baby behind by the French. He swam that final leg in 46.06 seconds. So is he clutch? Yeah. Every time he goes out there for his team and for America, he takes a second off his time. That's clutch. You can't tell me it ain't clutch.
It's like 5% faster or something. It's an incredible boost.
Yeah.
I just want to remind our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program. Our guest is noted author Poe Bronson. He's discussing his view that there is a science to success in politics, finance, sports, virtually all fields of endeavor. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV, F-O-R-A TV. We have a question from an 8-year-old girl in the audience, and if you write that you're an 8-year-old girl, I will ask your question every time. And Zoe would like to know, you can have fun with this, what is the most interesting chapter in the book? You may say all of them since you wrote it, but...
Yeah, well... What are you interested in, Zoe? What do you like to do? You like basketball?
I like basketball. Mm-hmm.
All right, so basketball. The basketball in the book, there's a couple different things. One is home field advantage. In basketball, the home team wins 63% of the time. And the question is, you know, why? And, you know, it's a game, what's going on? It's not like baseball where the court is different in everything and your roster is optimized like the Giants are optimized for mm-hmm. our local park. It's the same court, same hoop, all that kind of thing. Is it the crowd? Well, in European soccer, they've had entire teams and even leagues in Italy where they've had to play without fans, and the teams still win without the fans. And in American sports, we have a phenomenon that's happened in basketball where teams move to a different stadium across town. The fans are there. The support is there. You didn't have to stay in a hotel room. Everything's the same. But they don't have home field advantage for that first year. Hmm. And it's believed that this is sort of a deep-seated territorialism that's going on. It's a very primitive response over territory that triggers this. And what's interesting is we write in the book about some of the applications for this in the business world, where you, in negotiations where you can get to some places first, you can establish home field advantage. But for Zoe still, because that was the second most interesting thing about basketball, the most interesting thing is pay disparity. That in studies of pro basketball teams, we have this notion, egalitarian notion of teams, that to be a great team, you know, we're all kind of equal, we're equally represented, that makes people feel like they're recognized, and that they take responsibility because of that. And the science says it's actually the opposite. The science, the chapter there is called The Hierarchy of Teams, and it says that the most important thing teams can do is, one, be small, be as small as possible to get the job done, and two, have hierarchy and clear roles. And in basketball, they do studies of salaries, and they find that basketball teams where there is greater disparity in how players are paid, not equal pay, but greater disparity leads to 6 more wins a year. Hmm. So it, there's a bit, whole thing on the science of teams in the book.
Yeah, the home field advantage thing, I was having an argument during the NFL playoffs with someone about whether it's real or not, and I argued it is, and that the odds makers wouldn't give you a field goal for being at home if it wasn't, since their livelihood depends on it. Right. But how can you translate, you talked about business, how do you translate the concept of home field advantage outside the realm of sports, either to business or politics or in the home?
Well,
or
in politics, it's well known. I mean, diplomacy, you know, going back to Napoleon, has been done on rivers and on boats because people don't want it to be on somebody's home turf. And they know this. That we spend a whole long scene in the book with Kirk Hanlon, who was Clinton's advance man. And he was having negotiations over the negotiations kind of thing. And he was mm-hmm. in Japan. And the Japanese were trying to use all these home turf things. They were smoking in the room because they knew the Americans didn't want to smoke. And they were making their life miserable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a business setting, principally, that scholar named Graham Brown, he takes people and he has them come into the lab and they're going to do a negotiation. Negotiation scenarios are very common in the social sciences. And he has one person come first. He assigns them a room. He has them put up a couple posters. They've been in that room for 10 minutes. And they come out with 160% more out of the negotiation than the other person. That people naturally cede things. If you're going to meet with somebody at Starbucks, be first to Starbucks. If you're going to have a meeting with different teams at your workplace, say, hey, we'll have the bagels and coffee. Do something to establish that primitive sense of ownership that people do seem to cede to it subliminally in ways they do not realize.
That's fascinating.
It sounds a little like a parlor trick.
No, but it makes
it's
sense.
Not
too.
The most important thing in the book.
A lot of psychology.
That, yeah.
What are your suggestions for helping women to value competitive behavior in the workplace? Many times strong women are viewed as aggressive when a man in a similar position would be viewed as assertive.
Right. So this is what's interesting about the science of risk perception and how it applies in a daily life or, say, in an interview room. You know, men tend to be over-optimistic, so they can come into a room or a job interview and they can say, I'm going to do all these things for you. Just imagine it's a venture capital situation. The guy comes in, he thinks, I'm going to make you have a $1 billion company in 5 years. And he's falsely overconfident, but he's meeting the metrics that they want to see, which is a $1 billion company. The same person, if that was a woman coming in, she would be accurately judging the risk. She wouldn't be making all these false promises. She'd say, I'm going to have you $300 million company in the next 5 years. And venture capital says, I don't do anything under $1 billion. You know, and the same thing happens in an interview situation. Women come in and they pitch themselves very realistically. They promise what they can do and they can do it. But they're not over-promising in the sense they're not distorting the perception. And so men might get hired more than women in that same situation. So the most important thing is to be aware of this and to do something about it. Now, another generation, one of the things that I was shocked by was Joyce Bedens' work on kids in this area. Joyce is at Harvard and at Emmanuel College in Boston. She's been studying for quite some time, preschool play. And what she finds is she looks at the dynamics of group play versus dynamics of pair-based play, when there's two kids versus there's a group of kids. And in a group, there's often they have some reason that they belong together, and they have to be assertive to be heard. There's people there to be peacemakers if they have conflict. They're often playing a lot of games, and a lot of ways they set people up to learn to compete, you know, by spending a lot of time in group play. In pair-based play, kids take turns. There is no reason to have this relationship except to be similar to each other, so that people suppress differences, kids do, and they accentuate similarities. They pretend to like the same things to keep their friendship together. And self-deprecation is the conversational style of pairs. And so you have self-aggrandizement in groups or loudness, and you have self-deprecation in pairs. And what's shocking is that when kids are 2 or 3 years old, girls spend 1/3 of their time in groups and 2/3 of their time in pairs in their free play. Boys spend 2/3 of their time in group and 1/3 in pairs. And it's a crucial few years, because by the time they're 5 or 6, it jumps to boys are spending like 76% of their time in group play and girls only 16% of the time in group play. And what the scholars believe is that in pairs and in groups, we learn habits. Habits of conversation, habits of restoring a relationship, habits of how you play, and what are the costs of playing. And those habits stay with us later in life when we're no longer playing in groups and we're no longer playing in pairs. You still have in your psyche those styles that you learned from early life. And, we read this science, I guess, when my daughter, who is 8 now, was 6, so it was, like, too late. But I was like, you know, we definitely need to, like, have more than one other girl over for a play date, I'll tell you that.
You talk a lot in the book about siblings, and there's some very interesting material there. Before the Super Bowl, I did a story about the Harbaugh brothers, and you've got John, the Baltimore coach, who seems like this very gentle, loving guy, and his slightly younger brother, only 15 months, Jim, the 49ers coach, who's this hard-driving, rough-edged firebrand with not a lot of people skills, at least they're not visible to the media.
Yeah.
And the older one won the game, even though younger brothers often are more competitive and Jim seems more competitive, John won. Tell us a little bit about what you found as far as relationships between older and younger siblings and who's more competitive. And
right, and I related to this because I have an older brother and a younger brother.
Me too.
And I'll also say, kind of like the gender science, I really was like not gonna, like I didn't give a lot of credence to birth order stuff before mm-hmm. I read this stuff. And I still maybe don't to a lot of it, but particularly in this dimension, talking to Frank Soloway at Cal, really bright guy, really good scientist, and really good science and stuff. And it was kind of pretty surprising. So in Major League Baseball, there have been 350 pairs of brothers ever to play Major League Baseball, which is a pretty good data set. And it turns out that younger brothers are twice as likely to steal as older brothers are in the history of Major League Baseball.
Steal a base,
okay. Yeah.
Not from their agent.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And so you talk about young children. So first of all, just siblings compete all the time growing up, right? They compete over the remote control, the iPad. They compete over toys. They compete over food, parental affection, whose leg is where over crossing some invisible line at the back of the car. Siblings argue, you know, 3.5 times every hour. 10 minutes of every hour that they're together is spent arguing. They're getting used to kind of competitive psyche. They're not competing necessarily directly like they would later in life on a test or in a game, but what they're doing is learning to sort of stand up to somebody else and get used to the aroused emotions of antagonistic challenge. And what's most interesting is that younger siblings tend to have better competitive skills in life over time on average than oldest siblings. And you can kind of understand why. If you're a young kid and you're going to go out there on the soccer field or in school, you have to learn to keep going and not quit, even just because you're not the best person there. And that's something that younger siblings get used to all the time. They spend their whole home life around someone who's bigger than them, can take what they want, and wants to crush them all the time. And they learn to take risks and be pretty crafty about it. And I'm a middle child. At one point, I was the youngest sibling. I had that part in my life, early life. And so I thought I brought that with me. So even though later I was an older sibling as my younger brother came along, but I'd still had that mix in my life. I was not around the home. It was not always easy to sort of be the best at things. I was almost never the best.
A lot of the great explorers are second sons, younger brothers, Shackleton, Livingstone. There's a whole long list of them. They have to go out and make their way and find their fortune and prove themselves.
Right.
Is that part of what it is, that they have to prove that they're as good as the older brother? Did you look at that at all?
Well, that's actually Frank Soloway's research you're talking about. Mm. And so you could refer you to his books, which are excellent. And he would argue that's part of the psyche, you know, is that notion of proving yourself in comparison. But even if you don't compare yourself to others, not everybody responds to competitive pressure. Not everybody compares themselves to others. No, wait, that's wrong. Everybody compares themselves to others. 12% of the brain is devoted every day to thoughts of comparison of yourself to others around you, to yourself, to your future, yourself, to your past, yourself, to what could have happened or what didn't happen. 12% of thoughts are spun that way all the time. We may not be oriented that way. We may not react to it. And I would say maybe 25% of people don't really react to that. But even if you aren't someone who reacts to it, you still had to learn. You still grew up in that home. You still had to stick up for yourself.
Someone, this is interesting. I wonder if this is someone who's just started dating someone new. Is there a set of questions we can ask somebody's mother about their childhood to know how competitive they will be or are?
I got lost in all the relationships.
Is there a quiz you can give someone?
And ask the mother.
To ask the mother about their childhood to figure out how competitive they're going to be or are. You could just observe it.
Could
maybe.
Be a parent, maybe, who asked.
Maybe it's
that.
A parent. Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Is there an answer? Do you have an answer to that? We can move on if not.
No, I don't think that they're. Yeah, I don't think that the mom in particular part of it, like ask mom this or ask that, yeah.
You talked about, you know, the kids fighting in the back seat and how much time kids spend fighting. And you'll hear someone say, oh, it's just healthy competition. Is there healthy competition and unhealthy competition?
Yeah. And it's obvious, you know. I just, you know, this is, last Sunday was NASCAR. Last Sunday was Daytona 500. We write a scene in the book and of the day that NASCAR became the national sport, which was in 1979 at the Daytona 500. There was a day that a storm hit the east, and it was the first time that the NASCAR had ever been from the whole race was on TV that day. And because of the storm, the entire country was like socked in and had nothing to do but watch TV. And in this race, the Allison brothers, nicknamed the Alabama Gang, were tussling with Cale Yarborough during the race. And it came down to the final lap, and they were fighting it out. And they spun out and into the dirt. And Richard Petty eventually won. When the cameras stayed on those drivers who got out of their car and started beating each other up. Hitting each other with their helmets and stuff. And it did turn on the country to the sport in this way. Like, bloods were like, that's what happened. You sit around the couch with nothing to do all day. Like, but we are not telling that anecdote to glorify it. We're saying this was actually a predictable occurrence for that NASCAR, according to economists, had overjuiced this prize spread. The difference between first place and second place prizes and third place prizes was too great. And it was going to lead to crashes and bad behavior. And we compare it directly to the Glengarry Glen Ross, where in the movie version, not the play version, doesn't exist in the play version, but the character of Blake, played by Alec Baldwin, comes in and says, here's the prize spreads. First place, Cadillac Eldorado. Second place, steak knives. Third place, you're fired. And when you incentivize people that way, you're going to get cheating, right? When cheating occurs, especially now, some people are just jerks, and they're going to cheat in a competitive situation. And if they're not competing, they're going to cheat on their taxes or cheat in a different situation too. But when good people are tempted to cheat, it's often in a zero-sum game. And the most clear zero-sum game is in the American presidency race and how we establish that. It is a competition, and it's a winner-take-all competition. And the loser is a lot of shame involved with losing, and people make fun of you and all this stuff. And so that's one of the reasons why there is manipulation of money, there is lying, there is a lot of distortions that go into that race. People try to run a clean race but have a very hard time doing it. Because it's winner-take-all. In any situation where it feels winner-take-all, whether it is or not, standardized testing, SATs, those Taiwanese kids, it feels like winner-takes-all. That's when you get more what we call maladaptive competitiveness.
Question from the audience. How do you define a cheater? I think Lance Armstrong must be in our audience. How do you define a cheater? One who breaks the rules or one who gets caught? Lance brought that up, that issue.
Yeah. It's very clear. To me, to be a true competitor, you would never cheat. And if you are cheating, you have not learned how to compete correctly, and you have poor competitive skills. You know, competitive skills are not just about turning it up. They're also about turning it down. They're also about respecting the social circumstance and understanding when you should not be competitive. So maladaptive, one of the hallmarks of maladaptive competitiveness is like guy who can't turn it off. The surgeon who doesn't just want to be the best surgeon, he also has to be the best tennis player on the tennis court at the vacation home and can't stand losing. Like, to healthy competitive skills mean that you conserve your energy for the things that really matter.
And I talked to this about the scholars. You could go back to the gender science. They, for years, would bring in men and women into the lab, and they would give them this task, and they'd have them compete. You know, and men can turn dishwashing into a competition. Like, they'll do anything. Like, that sounds fun. They compete their heck out of it. And women would come in, and they wouldn't try as hard. And so the scholars were saying, you know, we don't want to talk about it, but women aren't as competitive. And I'm like, you know, maybe it's just dumb, stupid task. Who cares about that? They're saving their energy for the things that really matter. Mm-hmm. And that's appropriate. And this is how it comes up in school. Really interesting science is coming out of China, UK, the American South, with lottery schools, is that in elite competitive schools, girls do well uniformly. But for boys, the boys on top do well, but the boys who are not on top are actually depressed, not psychologically, their performance is depressed by being in that hyper-competitive environment. That boys have a harder time turning that competitiveness off. So to live day in, day out, where you're like, you know, near the bottom, really erodes their psyche. And so there's actually showing that, you know, we think that, you know, to win those school lotteries and go to the school of your dreams is your best chance of getting into college. The kids, the boys who did not win the lottery, did not go to the school of dreams, but still wanted to, right? So it's self-selected. They had a better chance of going to college than the kids who got into the school of their dreams. Something very shocking is going on. And it's important, the ability to turn off relentlessly self-comparing yourself to others is a crucial competitive skill as well.
What makes someone adaptively competitive or maladaptively, other than the gender differences you're talking about? And is that something that you can identify, define, predict?
You know, I mean, developmentally, people need, the most important thing is that people need to lose. They need to go through a lot of losing. They need to learn that losing isn't such a big deal. Like as little kids, you know, one of the things, it's been really great. Our daughter has wanted to play a lot of crazy eights lately. And she's been doing it with the babysitter. She's eight. And it's terrific for her because she's like, you know, dad, mom, this is, you know, there's no skill to this game. Like, so in that sense, there's no shame in losing. So she could, you know, the first time she lost, she was a tiny bit stressed out. Now she loses no problem. She's learning it's not that big a deal. And then when losing is not that big a deal, then later on in life, when you want to take a risk, and you're not going to be less scared of losing. To, in many circumstances, to compete is to take risks that are normally constrained by fear. And to tap into hidden reserves of energy, to be creative, to come up with something you had not done before, and to take a risk, to put yourself out there into the world, and in front of judgment, in front of others. And that is hard to do. But the only way you can learn to do it is by learning that losing isn't that big a deal. It doesn't really stigmatize you.
How much does fear of embarrassment motivate people, fear of failing in public in front of people, rather than necessarily the competitive desire to beat someone else, but to not be seen as a loser?
It's very common. It's one of the reasons why the book is called The Science of Winning and Losing. Some people want to win. Some people don't care if they want to win, but they don't want to lose. You know, they just don't want to sort of be seen near the bottom. And so people have different orientations that way. So that's a very common way. Psychologists, psychiatrists measure that type of orientation quite a bit.
Question from the audience. How does one become more comfortable in dealing with competition in the workplace and life? Sounds like one of the ways is to lose a few times.
Yeah, well, all of these things, all the things we've been talking about are part of how you get more comfortable with that competition. Again, sort of developmentally, you know, growing up, where I thought it was most interesting was, again, in an academic setting. So, because I've already planted a few seeds here, we've talked about kids' sports and stuff. Mm-hmm. We've talked about SAT performance and high-stakes testing. Most interesting thing to me in this realm is the number of scholars who are now saying what kids need in school is not less competition but more, but it has to be the right kind. It has to be the kind that's modeled on the kinds of competitions they naturally enjoy. So if you think about taking the SAT, it's not a game, but you could see it as a game. It's a game where only the final score counts. There's no other reason to do it. People live with that final score forever. It's not like other stuff in childhood, Boy Scouts, science fairs, you know, youth hockey, where you say, well, you know, I bombed, we lost, but I made a lot of friends at the Kaplan Center. You know, you don't say, well, I didn't do well on the test, but I sure learned a lot of words. That's going to help me later. Our sense of what is healthy competition comes to us quite naturally. And the scholars are saying that kids need more science fairs, spelling bees, chess clubs, ways that those are healthy competition, where they're learning to use their brain, learning to perform. You know, our son was in the science fair recently. He didn't win. He's not going to the Randall Museum. But for a moment, you know, the judges came around and he had to present and he nailed it. And for a moment, that felt like a victory. And that's healthy.
You talk in the book about how the best symphonies have the unhappiest musicians. You talked a bit about the musical realm. Can you explain that for people who haven't read it?
Well, very specifically, you know, musicians grow up wanting to be stars, right? And so this is work that looks at orchestras and symphonies around the world, and they find that the better they perform on stage, the more harmony on the stage, the more discord off the stage. So it's the grand opera on stage, and it's the soap opera off stage. And, well, it's not really a mystery why. I mean, you know, to have wanted your whole life to be a soloist and then, like, and stand out, and now you're there at first chair, and you have to sound exactly like everybody else, is asking people to do something that they were not trying to do for much of their life. And so they're suppressing a lot of feelings and stuff that can come out off stage. But we use it in the book to show that that the science of teams, there's arguments for why you need people on a team who are not team players. That discord on a team is crucial because teams, if they're a real team, they're going to face challenges. In the face of challenge, you have to have ideas. You can't have groupthink. You know, you need to be able to debate what is the right course. And having an accepted level of discord on a team tends to allow those things to come out and allow teams to succeed.
Question from someone in the audience. Say the odds are stacked against you. You're a middle-aged only child with a longer index finger. How do you optimize and develop a healthy, effective sense of competitiveness?
Hypothetically.
Hypothetically.
You know, well, what does, again, it's similar to the talking about like the warrior gene, and I said, don't think that having the warrior gene is a bad thing, like the Secretary of State should have warrior genes. You know, people perform their best in certain situations, and finding the, for someone who needs it, the low stress environment where they perform their best is how it's going to make them perform, you know, better. It's about recognizing who you are. And, you know, some people, you know, shouldn't be, you know, they're not going to be primed to taking risks, but they can be very good at evaluating risk. And they can, you know, Ashley and I are two teammates. We're a very small team. We don't compete against each other, but we are different. And, you know, I'm more prone to take risks, she's less, but we balance each other. So being in an environment where you're balanced around other people, still, I think most people are doing fine.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our show where there's time for only one last question, and we can go on a little bit about this, but someone from the audience wants to know, what is your next book going to be? Have you started working on something already, and is it going to stay in this realm? You sort of had an evolution from Nurture Shock to competitiveness. Where are you going next?
It's a fair question, and people might think I'm just like not wanting to tell you when I say I have no idea. But I've never had any idea. I've never written the same book. But now I kind of understand why, which is that, you know, after I do something, I mean, I set out to do something, and I'm totally, in retrospect, I see it, I'm totally over-optimistic. I think I can do this book, and I, when in the middle of it, I'm like, I did not realize how hard it was going to be, and I mean, I remember it being hard, but this is harder than I remember, and to publish it is stressful, and you feel judged, and I need, after all that, a lot of rest and recuperation. I do. And so I don't want to think about my next book. I want to overtly not think about it for a year at least. But that's And I used to think that was my problem, but now I realize that's my strength. That is who I am. Embrace it. Do that, you know. Do other things with my time over the next year, and then give myself psychic room so I can summon the energy to do it again next time.
Is this why you are now writing with a female co-author, so you can have a more realistic assessment of how hard the project will be and whether you can get it done?
This being my seventh book and Ashley's second book, she has, you know, she's, it's easy for her to want to write her second book, but for me, it's a little like, I kind of done that, you know, so it's harder to have the stamina, and that hunger, you know, so you have to pick your topics very, very carefully, because you're just going to live with it for 4 years, and it's going to live with you permanently, you know, it's associated with your name. So, Ashley's just more eager, a little more eager than me to write any book, and I'm a little more like selective, actually, in this case. So we might flip-flop it. I'm like, nah, I want to really, only for the right book will I go through this again.
Well, our thanks to Poe Bronson. I think we've all learned a lot, and you can learn a lot more when you take a look at this book, author of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. And we want to remind everyone who's here in the room that copies of Mr. Bronson's new book are on sale in the lobby. He'll be pleased to sign them for you as soon as we're done. We appreciate your letting him make his way to the lobby and the signing table as quickly as possible. I'm Doug Sovereign, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. That's fun.